already talking. We're already talking about some interesting things.
Yeah. But, oh, here, can you let me record it too?
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Sweet.
So it's no. And again, I myself, about the only time I ever feel depressed is right before I get ill. And that's almost always a sign. If I'm getting the flu, or, you know, when I had COVID, about the day or two before, I feel it. And it's like, and I've seen that enough in me that I say, oh, I must be getting sick because I feel depressed. And I seldom.
You're just not inclined in that direction.
Not inclined in that direction at all. But it's a strange, strange thing, because it's even difficult to describe, because it's so close, but yet it's alien enough that you can, at least I can recognize it. I've known other people that were depressed, and they, for them, that was sort of their primary experience of existence. And that's really hard.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And it's so interesting when it's at that level for people, it's when it's really at a biological, I guess it's biological level. It's strange because there's such, I mean, emotionally, when we usually talk about emotions, right, they're just so tied up with morality and everything, right? But there's something deeply, you know, this indication that, like, there's a sense of like, when you're depressed, like, it's a signal of, like, something's wrong, right? Do something different. But I'm not gonna give you the state that will help you do that different thing. Yeah. But I'll demand that, right, you do something different. And it's kind of can get this moral, this weird moral, like, dilemma to it.
Yeah.
But when it goes so deep, it's like, it just seems to be deeply physical.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know if you've seen any of Michael Levin's work. He works on electroceuticals.
Yeah.
And
he's fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, just the fact that, you know, as I said, I've known people who've gotten electroconvulsive shock therapy, and it's, you know, they seem to just basically reset the brain in a sense by, you know, with a massive amount of electricity. And I don't know how it works, but there was an individual that he was seriously depressed. I mean, seriously, seriously depressed. And with a course of treatment, he, at least for a while, had a pretty normal life. And it is so mysterious too, like, as you said, because of the, you know, obviously when someone, say, loses a spouse or a child or a loved one, you know, that will induce depression.
Yeah.
And so I do think that our mappings of consciousness and mood are quite deficient. It remains more mysterious than often we let on to.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, but I mean, speaking to what contributes to, I mean, so much of this too, I really appreciated your commentary on the video that you commented about. I think it was the last, after Socrates conversation. I think there's so much what I appreciated about your commentary, but just that I felt like you captured the essence of what was being said and, like, really deepened it in a way that was helpful for me to understand what I was saying.
Well, I hadn't heard, I mean, when you sort of went on this riff about relationships, I hadn't really heard something that sort of brought it to the fore that clearly for me, this bind that we are. And I think, you know, it starts with the answering machine and then all these screens, you know, and I see it in myself sometimes. You know, I'm busy, I've got things to do, And not, you know, now it's not just people at church who are sort of weighing on me. It's people in the internet world who are weighing on me. And I'm trying to think about how to be responsible and fair to all of these people. And you begin to recognize that these screens are a false, you know, that they're a false relationship where I can sort of turn people on and off. And then if they, you know, annoy me or bother me in a certain way that are unwelcome, I just get rid of them. And this is what's happening in a massive way in our society now. Increasingly, yeah, people are living alone.
Yeah.
If they have the option. And, you know, I have a fair amount of contact with homeless people. Hmm. Many of the homeless people are either their loved ones. Most of the homeless people in this area have loved ones within walking distance who, yeah, live in a house.
Yeah.
And either the people themselves have left or they've been kicked out.
Yeah.
And many homeless people have basically told me, why would I pay to have someone annoy me? I would rather suffer the elements, suffer the degradation. You know, there's also mental health and substance abuse issues often with these people, but I would rather suffer all of these things that have to deal with people. And,
yeah,
and those are extreme cases, obviously, but I thought in that video, the way you said it was like, bang, wow.
Yeah.
It just,
yeah,
kind of put it right there for me.
Right. Because it's, and also the, where you took it a bit even further back, which is like, you could say that the, this uncoupling of language, right, from relation, like, I mean, that happened, alphabetic like language was this kind of uncoupling from it. And even you could imagine in some sense, maybe the very first uncoupling of it, or is an abstraction of this, like going from hunter-gatherer, being in your tribe, to where if you could just imagine what the language would sound like, where everyone that you talked to, you had known your whole life, right? And they had known everyone that you knew their whole life, right? And the only time language was exchanged, right, was in this context of relation. I wonder if we would even be able to recognize it as language as we understand it now, because I would imagine it would just infuse so much gesture and so many things that are directly relational and reflective of that space. But then it would be the next, right? But then if you can imagine when my tribe starts to talk to your tribe, then all of a sudden, the way I say it, there needs to be something like a standing out of the word, right? And that we say that same word and it meets, and it's somewhat divorced from the context of relation. So it's like, if we just play that forward, and then, you know, to think about, you know, what alphabetic becoming literate, right? Yeah. It's just, I just have this sense that I have no idea how profound that was,
yeah,
of a shift that made for us.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And you probably see a little bit of it with, you know, twins, especially identical twins, can sometimes develop their own language. They have their own words, and, you know, they're genetic copies of each other. They've been in the womb together. You know, that drifts obviously as they go out into the world, but it's, I mean, these issues are so deep and so mysterious.
Yeah.
You know, and you can touch on the mysteries of them. So I've been, you know, my wife and I have been married now. We had our 35th wedding anniversary this summer. So, you know, we knew each other a couple of years before we were married, but we've been married for 35 years. We have 5 children together. You know, we've lived a lot of life together, ups and downs and goods and bads. And, you know, sometimes it's amazing how well you know the other person. And sometimes it's amazing how well you don't know the other person. And it's amazing how even, you know, after 35 years, sometimes one of us will say something to the other person and it'll be like just completely completely yes. missed it. And, yes. and you'd think 35 years, 35 yeah. years, five children, yeah. all this life together,
yeah.
having to hash out how many things and still, and for me, all of these things are, for me, they are tells of the reality that I believe this life is really just a beginning of far of a much longer story than the 80 or 100 years or 50 or 60 years we get to live yeah. and create story in this world, because it would be just a real shame if all of what we're touching on and how vast it is and mysterious it is, this is all we can actually engage with.
Yeah. 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 So you're saying there's gotta be, or there at least ought to be, a sense in which this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
Because the waters run so deep. And I think what I heard you say is you have probably what it means to be married to your wife is the continual deepening realization is that there you haven't hit the bottom of her yet.
No, and not even close.
Yeah.
And we find that in how many different times and places and ways in this creation. I mean, it is so deep and so profound and on one hand, knowable, but on the other hand, there's, you know, how many lifetimes would I need to even know a single domain well?
Yeah, totally.
So clearly my wife and I know each other, but we you know, it's so funny, after even 35 years of marriage, something will happen and we'll look at each other like we're mysteries to one another. And then we sort of laugh, how can this be? But here we are. So I, you know, that's for me, that is a hope, and also for me kind of a sign that I don't think our time in this world is all we are. I think everything goes a lot deeper, and I think we're made to go deeper with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's something I would like as I'm hearing that, I'm kind of sensing, getting a sense of what relationship starts to be an opening for, right? In this way, because on another level, it's unusual, because, and I feel the same way about my wife, and I know my wife is continually perplexed with probably both positively and negatively, right? Like with my own being. But there is this way in which we could sit in front of each other. I know I talk a lot about this in Circling. We can sit in front of each other and we could spend 1,000 years and describing everything that we could know to describe, right? Saying all the truth. And there's something innately that will always withdraw into mystery, even from me, even most so from me, yeah. right?
Yeah.
And yeah. and at the same time, like, we could say that, you know, when I watch my little boy who's two and look up, right, look at his relationship with his mom, right, which they're like this. I'm looking at, like, they know each other. Like, I mean, he just has a little bleep and she hears paragraphs. I don't hear, right?
Yep.
There's a level of which even our nervous system and our eyes are designed to see facial features and differences between things that are so minute, right, compared to other differences. So then there's this other way where, like, we shine forth, right, in particularity and are more knowable than almost anything else that we could say.
Yeah.
So there's this, it seems like when we face each other, there are these two places where it's like there's this deep shining forth, but at the same time, a withdrawing into the mystery.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that that's when you start to think about, well, what is intimacy then, right? And you bring that together, all of a sudden I start to feel like something like, I would imagine what you're alluding to, of like there seems to be an eternality that's necessary, right? To make room for such a thing to even have a sense of.
Right. Right. And the, when you think about, I mean, we've, you know, my wife and I, we have five children, and the 18 years or so that they live with us before they go off to college and then out from there, it's, I mean, what's amazing about, and what's why I tell people, I say, you know, if you don't have children, you are missing out on one of the most meaningful things that life has to offer. It just keeps getting, yeah, it can be painful. You know, there's, with almost everything in life worth value, there's risk, but at the same time, the mystery. One of our kids just graduated college and is living back at home while he looks for a permanent job. And, you know, just, you know, 5 years away at college, getting to know him again, seeing how he's different from the four that came before him. And it is just simply profound.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's common. I mean, people have children. It's a fairly common thing, and people get to know them. But it's, if you have eyes to see and you pay attention and you watch, it's quite a remarkable gift that we've been given to know each other. And so then again, as you mentioned, intimacy. Mark Lefebvre, one of the guys, in this little corner, he talks about intimacy crisis. And again, what you pointed to is, I mean, intimacy is terrifying.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, a lowering of the walls. And it's why for many people, divorce is worse than death, because you've afforded all of that intimacy, which means that now suddenly when there's hostility, you have all of that weaponry.
Yeah.
And because no one can, you know, no one can hurt you more than someone who really knows you well.
Yeah.
And yet the, you know, the, what you observed in that clip, how if in fact that there's this weird tension that if intimacy is optional, if we can sort of steal the fruits of intimacy without the risk, we'll do it.
Yeah.
And suffer for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you think about how that scales up broadly throughout society,
yeah,
you can get a sense of, wow, we're running a vast experiment right now as a culture that humanity has never run before. And we have very little idea of what will come of all of this.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Just this idea that where relationship has become optional. Just the fact that's just part of facticity at this point, right? Of like, we're, for the most part, we still need relationship to kind of get them through a certain age, but past and younger, right? If they have an internet connection, like a little, like a kid could become a millionaire and automate all of his relationships and never like do everything on text. And it's that's possible. In some sense, you know, as I'm thinking about it now, as you brought up this thing about intimacy being terrifying, you're right. It is totally terrifying. Like, in some ways, it's more terrifying than any kind of physical terror, in a way,
yeah.
Right? Because there's a, yeah, something deeply is at stake in a moment of intimacy.
You see that the difference with boys and girls.
Yeah.
I mean, boys get sideways with each other. They hit each other a little bit, rough it up, and then it's kind of over.
Totally.
Girls now, especially with social media, you know, we've handed teenage girls, you know, something comparable to relational nuclear weapons. And no wonder, you know, teenage suicidality and all of these metrics are, and it's probably because, again, women are more dependent on intimacy than men because you know, you talk about your two-year-old's bond to his mother. She had a 9-month start, and she had, you know, an intimacy with your child that, you know, I always, you know, even with all the 5 kids, you know, you feel the belly and the movement and you're there for the birth. But I always, as a father, it's like, you don't really start to catch up until about 4 or 5 months, where they start making eye contact and they start smiling.
Yes.
And that's where the father can sort of begin a relationship. And, but mom is, women, there's a reason for the structure here.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. So if that becomes optional, and as you're saying, we can get derivative forms of it even.
Yeah.
Right?
Knockoffs, and, you know, intimacy knockoffs.
Yeah, totally. And then we have, I mean, this is all happening within, you know, it's exponential, the progress of these kind of technologies. So it's, I just have this sense that, like, in a couple more generations, will the human being be recognizable to us in some way? There is a sense of when I connect with Gen Z, what's this one, that the most recent one,
the millennials,
yeah, like, no, the one after that.
Oh, Gen Z, I guess it's Gen Z.
The ones that don't have a memory before the internet.
Yeah.
For many of them, were just raised already, always on a screen. Yeah. Right? There is a real different sense about the way that they grip on the world.
Yeah.
That's very, very, very different. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And when you look at our mortality, this is, I went back to the Bay Area.
So you're not living in the Bay Area anymore?
No, I moved to Modesto, actually. I'm living with Brianne, my wife's parents.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because we're going to have more kids.
Oh, okay.
And we're going to have more family around and all that kind of stuff. So out of that spirit, we moved to Modesto, which is not that far away.
It's not that far away. Yeah. No, not at all. But the Valley is a different culture. The Central Valley is a different culture than the Bay Area.
Totally different. It's really different. Yeah, yeah, it's really different.
Yeah,
I'm still don't know how I feel about it, but I like just the first of all, I don't understand how we were able to do it without her parents. Now that we have her parents, right? Like, just to have a kid is like, so it's so much, right? So to have as many hands into that, right, the better. But I went back to a party. I was back there a couple of weeks ago and went to a party and got in a conversation just on the way out to somebody I had met. We ended up having this like 45-minute connection where she basically shared with me everything that her and her sister went through to be at the death of both of her parents, who happened to die on the same day in the same hospice.
Oh,
right?
My.
And she just kind of went through this whole litany of, she turned her life upside down, so as to be able to have that moment with them, right? And to describe that moment and the whole experience. And I was just thinking about like I can't think of a human being that wouldn't want to receive that, right? To like, to have a sense where there are people that will change their life in order to be so you can die. In that way.
Yeah.
And I got a taste of that, right? Like with her, and a very, very deep taste. That sense of a willingness to do that, right? Having it even occur as something to do, I think is fading in a big way.
I see. So when you're a parent, I mean, being a parent is exhausting. And it's not just exhausting, especially if you, you know, you're trying to earn two incomes and parent. And that's not just it. It's that children, you know, children are creating their first draft maps and they're taking them from you. Children take from you. They really do. And that makes it easy. That dynamic that you pointed to makes it easy to, oh, if I can put my kid in front of a screen, you know, sort of started with radio, books too. But it seems like with every successive evolution, it gets worse. And so now you'll go into Walmart and you'll see two-year-olds on shopping carts with little screens while mama's trying to buy stuff. And I think what we're going to see is, you know, we're seeing sort of the pushback where other groups, often religious groups, are sort of, they've got enough long history. They might have enough long history where they already sort of have antibodies against these things. I mean, religious people were some of the last to let the television in the house. And there's a certain suspicion that comes with, you know, deeply religious and often conservative people. And so you see these homeschooling movements, and you see more and more of these communities that are trying to, as best they can, sort of unplug. And it's never going to be perfect. And there's always going to be sort of whip back dynamics with some that you sheltered the kids, and so once they get a breath of fresh air, they're gonna, you know, go out. And but it's, I think what we're going to see actually are increasingly haves and have nots with respect to capacity for intimacy and relationality, that people who from an early age were raised with adults paying attention to them and vice versa, were raised with limits on screens and this panopticon that we're building, that sheltering them for probably as long as they can, because at some point they're going to get out into the world and they're going to make their own choices. In some ways, you know, all religious people are Amish, and, you know, teenagehood is Rumspringa for, you know, the world. And but we're going to see differences in people, and we already can, you know, even the way you watch immigrants to the United States. Now, it's not a fair sample because you have to have a fair amount of initiative to be an immigrant, especially an illegal immigrant. But there's a reason people hire them and trust them, because they're coming from cultures that have been less torn apart than our own.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I think we're going to see haves and have nots in these areas. And I think the differences are going to be more and more noticeable as this continues to evolve.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, totally. I mean, it's in some sense, you know, where I kind of come at thinking about this is realizing that in many ways, when I look at, for example, the work that I do with circling, it's it I've had to come to the realization of what circling was through. It took me a while to really understand that in some sense, circling was a response to the very thing that we're talking about, like the relational crisis, if you will, right? That in some sense, the shape, because it was really interesting of developing circling, because there was always this sense similar to a piece of art, right? Where I have an idea in my head and I make the mark, and the mark is never what is exactly what I think. It pushes back. It has something to say about what it is that I then respond to, right? But there's that thing that pushes back, right? And in some sense, you know, paint, like the shaping the face of circling, in some sense, is a positive or a negative image of what it was responding to, right? And I think this is really it, is this, in some sense, circling is a, for the, and what's interesting, here's what's interesting about it too, is it's similar to like a gym, right? Where you take that part that's most scary, essentially, and then put a seal around it, right? Make an agreement, you know, ground ourselves in some agreement and start to practice the machinery of essentially reciprocal opening, right? And the transcendence that kind of comes with that. And I was thinking about that in some ways, this focus on quality, on the qualitative aspect of relation, right, is one of the things that it's really this is afforded in some sense, right? Which is, whereas before, like before, you know, before the answering machine, right, in some sense, life required so many such a quantity of relationality, right, that you, at least your nervous system got the back and forth, right? And all of the coordination and regulation of the quantity of relationships, right? Of all the things that can happen in a conversation, which is, by the way, infinite, yes, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And can everything from destroying your sense of yourself and needing therapy for 20 years to being enlightened like the Buddha, like all of that can happen in this conversation, right? In some way. So we just so radically are open to each other.
Yeah.
And it's these conversations, which is how we become people.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Is through in and through relationship.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Pete, and I, you know, that was Verveke's in Awakening from the Meaning Crisis is agape. I mean, he nailed that right. This is how we become people. Yeah. We catch it from other people.
Yeah.
And we're given it from other people, or yeah, sometimes we steal it from other people if no one is giving it.
Yeah.
I heard a story today of two grade school boys. And one said to the other, you know, you know, you're unworthy of love. These are fifth graders. You're unworthy of love and you have no right to be here. And I thought to myself, I cannot imagine having that language when I was in fifth grade to say to another boy in my class.
Wow.
And I just think we're living in a strange time where on one hand we are failing by virtue of the structure of how we're living and how we're raising children. We are failing to give capacity to children, relational capacity, intimacy capacity, while at the same time we're handing them language. You know, it's like we're stripping away, Grim Grizz talks about defense of the dark arts. We're stripping away, you know, relational capacity is also defensive. Because as you grow in capacity, you can, you know, it's more like wrestling back and forth. So in a sense, we're not teaching people to grapple, but we're giving them knives. And when I heard that of one fifth grader saying, and they were boys, they weren't even girls. I'd more expect that of fifth grade girls than boys, because the girls are always ahead.
Yeah.
I heard that and I thought, my goodness, what are we doing to these children? Of course, the other child was deeply hurt. Of course they were deeply hurt.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in those upper elementaries, there's a lot of frenemies around, you know, there's sort of rivalries, and this is all part of the growing and relational capacity. And then it's basically this one child basically pulls a relational knife. And I think, you know, humanity is astoundingly resilient, because when you read back in history, it's amazing what human beings have survived. Yet I think we should also give ourselves a degree of credit that we are also living in a society where we have achieved a considerable amount of civility and nonviolence as compared to many other cultures in the past. And I worry that, you know, a lot of this imbalance between relational capacity and then relational weaponry is going to wreak havoc, and we might lose a lot of what we've achieved.
I like the way that you kind of laid that out, although I didn't like what was laid out. Right? In some rich, yeah.
I see this in the loss of religious institutions, because what's happened in many respects to churches in America is that, you know, a consumerist ethos has kind of taken over, and people approach churches in the way that they've approached other institutions, and even implicit institutions like marriage. We have pretty much said in our culture now that the measure of a marriage is what you get out of it. And marriage is, I mean, I people certainly do get wonderful things out of marriage. They can, but that's not the measure of a marriage. Yeah. Because, you know, especially if there's children, there's parents and family, a marriage is a very different thing than a consumer product. And churches have increasingly become consumer products instead of communities. And that, you know, that is part of the reason churches are struggling, because, again, for all the things you laid out in that little clip, if I can get my religious teaching, if I can get my feels from the music, if I can get my, and then if something happens that I don't like, I turn it off.
Yeah. 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 Totally. I'm curious, from your perspective, what was it before this, before it took this turn? Religion, right? The attitude towards religion. What was marriage at one point, right?
Well,
relationship to church and what was religion?
I know. So part of what we're dealing with also is, in many respects, even on YouTube, we are mostly engaging people sort of above the waterline, people who have had enough competence to afford an internet connection. And I know a lot of people hear that and think, who can't afford an internet connection? You'd be surprised. Yeah. I know couples who have divorced and continue to share the same home because they basically can't afford to live apart.
Yeah.
You know, part of how part of why I think how humanity got so adept at relationality in the past is because it had to for survival. And that also, of course, bred violence and, you know, all kinds of other ugliness. But in almost, you know, in so many cases, the amazing capacities that human beings have been granted to us by necessity in the past. And marriages are amazingly broad institutions where, you know, I remember one man in this church years ago. He was in his second marriage, and first marriage was a mess. He didn't, you know, divorces are complicated. I mean, even people who had a bad marriage often look back with a bit of nostalgia about the goodness of the bad marriage that they missed.
Yeah.
And this person just basically said to me, if I hadn't been divorced financially, I would be in a much better place. And that's very common. It's not a hard thing to see. But that's just an element of marriage by virtue of necessity forced people to level up relationally and usually to their capacity, because you also bump into the fact that you meet people who have simply limited relational capacities.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they're not going to get another level of transformation, not going to get another level. But all of that brutal, difficult hardship, necessity, and humanity afforded us capacity. And that's, you know, it's sort of like what happened with COVID when we had the supply chain problems, because all of these networks had basically wrung out all of the excess capacity in order to get efficiency.
Yeah.
And then suddenly when there was a disruption, suddenly nobody had capacity. And I think that's sort of what we're treading at here.
Right. Right. Oh, totally. It's, you know, it's funny because I'm thinking about the ride I went on to have another kid at 50, essentially, which, I mean, it was something to have the first one, which I have a 20-year-old, right? And I had him in my, you know, in my 30s, my early 30s. But then to have to be with a woman who didn't ever want to have kids, right? Come to want to have kids, right? Because she started watching Jordan Peterson, right?
Another Jordan Peterson baby.
Yeah. But the more to morally kind of, in some sense, confront all of my resistance, right, to having kids later in life, right? And I had every single reason to not have them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the one thing that I think ultimately where it came down to for me is this sense of, like, it's almost like, in some way, if I'm going to be with a woman, right, how could I deny her that and be with her, truly be with her, her is everything. And there was also a moment where the real positive that exemplified itself when she came home, you know, right when I was in the middle of like trying to figure all this out, which you just can't figure out with your frontal lobes, right?
No.
You just can't figure that stuff out. Some things are just deeper than you can understand.
Yeah.
And when she came home after spending some time with her sisters who had just had a couple of babies, and she walked in and she came home and there was a glow about her. And I saw a part of her that I realized instantly would only blossom fully if she was a mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was, the moment I saw that and I saw how beautiful that was, it went right past my head all the way into my heart. And then it was like, and it's really been true. It's been true because I feel like I've witnessed two births, right?
Yeah.
There's the birth of my son Teague, and that's a miracle. But there's also this miracle of watching her, right, be born as a mother and discover, right, this thing that she had. She's one that didn't have a whole lot of biochemical urge until she had one. And when she had one, she realized it's like she talks about, this is what I'm like, this is no wonder all these things didn't work for me my whole life, right? It's like, because this is what I was supposed to do. It's so, and it is really obvious. It's really amazing to watch that transformation.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Oh, I think you're totally right. You see it all you see it. And the sad wonder is, how have we as a culture, I mean, what number have we as a culture done to how many women with respect to this? Because they have a window, you know? And there are a number of people in my circles who regularly, you know, say 20 years from now, there's going to be a lot of women past childbearing age who were told your career is what you were made for, or maybe hedonism is what you were made for. And they are not going to be happy about that lie that they were fed. And they'll have some responsibility because they did believe it. I mean, it always goes both ways on that, but no, it's such a wonder when it happens. And it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. And I, you know, I appreciate I just turned 60 this year. But I remember when I was 50 and a friend of mine, he had a relationship in which he had 3 children fairly young. And then he married a woman and she was a little bit younger than him. And he had 2 more children with her. And I was about 50 then. And I thought, oh, he's starting that clock over. when my youngest graduated from college, a certain part of me just said,
yeah, totally.
You know, he's in his early 20s. You know, he's got a lot to learn yet, but there's a certain degree that I am no longer responsible for him, and he'll make messes of his own, and those will be sad, but it's different than when, you know, college is paid for 5.
Oh. Yeah, at this point, I'm going to be changing diapers into my 90s.
I hope
we got it, because we have a couple more coming that we're shooting for.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Stay healthy.
it's something, because I think it's almost impossible to explain. There's something so deeply ineffable about the meaningfulness of, like, literally, like, me and my wife sit and, like, literally watch Teague and there's some miracle of, like, looking at his face. And it's something like, I think that as his parents were present to this point where he didn't exist, and you start to feel, it's in some sense, you can see his non-existence, right? For which his existence then shines through. So it's like, there's some kind of eternal sense that kind of comes through his face. It's just like this, it's this uncanny thing that I haven't been able to get over yet. Right.
Where it's continually,
cause it's like, if you're looking at, if you think about what you're looking at, when you're looking at a human face, right. One forming, right.
Yeah.
You're watching meaning itself. Right.
Yeah. Walter Percy has a little book, Lost in the Cosmos, which is a fun little book where he just lists all sorts of things that you can't explain. And one of them is just like you just said, you know, to look, why is it when you walk down the street, you know, you glance in people's eyes, but you won't stop and stare in another person? What's with that? Yeah. I mean, my dog will sit up there and stare in my eyes, but another human being, you just have a sense of, there's a, again, to me, this is another tell of eternity, that when you're looking into another human being, this is a, you know, my dog is an amazing creature, but another human being is another category. And why all the mystery? And, but here we are living in the midst of it.
Yeah, totally. And this sense of, I'm reading something right now about this woman making a link between essentially demographics, right? The decline in demographics in Western European nations and pretty much all over the world, right? Yeah. Why that's happening, and the connection to religion and nihilism and in the meaning crisis and all of this. And she's making this link with not just the shift out of religion, right? But I'm in the middle of it, so I don't grasp the whole thing, but she's making this deep connection between, it's when the family and the church were so afforded that connection that when the church started to change and the family started to change, right? Those two uncoupling in some deep fundamental way, right? Which she's saying is an underrepresented factor, right? Of the shift out of the secular, or like into the secular, yeah, right? Into modernity.
The church question is really been fascinating me lately. I've been reading some books on demographics and church. And whereas when we think of the medieval period, we think about church as a dominant institution, which it was, but the percentage of the population that participated in church directly, especially regularly, let's say, you know, weekly or even monthly, was smaller than we might imagine. We tend to look back and imagine that in years gone past, everybody went to church, where in effect, church participation rose and fell quite dramatically all throughout history. Yet, I think you're really onto something in terms of this family connection. Yet, in terms of the culture, church and religion was sort of the medium out of which everything mm-hmm. sprung. It was that common worldview, and the church sort of, you know, fed that thing in the culture that families then grew out of.
Right.
And part of what has happened, I mean, I have also continued to think about secularity, because in many ways, what we call secularity was a daughter of the church, because it's created by the church. It comes out of Christendom, Latin Christendom in the West. And I think, you know, people understood that Hindus, Buddhists, Africans, they're just not going to download all of this stuff. And it's not going to be like they are. Many of those niches are already filled by their religions.
Yeah.
So what happens is this very interesting sort of pseudo religion called secularity, which had deep roots in Christianity, sort of puts a covering over the world. Yeah. And now we're in a time when, you know, Islam first, Hinduism now, communism did it. A lot of cultures are sort of trying to get rid of that, but yet there was a lot that sunk in. And I think many of the religions of the world have been sort of shaped in ways that are surprising, and some people are very sensitive to it this. And so, but now in our own culture, I just don't think we have any idea what's going on with respect to these issues. I really don't. The more I think about them, the more I think we just really don't know. Because the religion and the secular, especially in Christendom, are so tight that, you know, when Jordan Peterson says to Sam Harris that he believes in God, I understand Sam's, you know, reaction, but Peterson also has a point that all of this stuff is just so much around us. It's built into our ethics. It's built into our moral instincts. And now with, because it is secularity and this way of life in the West that has undermined our relational capacity. It has, and of course, church and family are dependent on relational capacities. And when there's a poverty of relational capacities, you know, families can't hold together and churches can't hold together. And then you're just going to at some point have questions about can, you know, nation states hold together?
Yeah.
Because I think they're also downstream from all of this.
Yeah. That's the thing that I think we don't totally understand all the way and the implications of that, right? Of that. Yeah, you're right. Nation states are complete. Like, I mean, they're in some sense an evolvement of, right?
Yeah.
Judeo-Christian values in such a deep way, including including its, as you said, its very secularization in some way, as Nietzsche pointed out, is this deep trust in truth, right? In some ways, like, accounted for the shoring up, you know, the truing up of all of that. And it's also why, I don't know, Sam Harris occurs for me. I listen to him. If I didn't know what he said about himself explicitly, he's like the most worried clergyman. Like, he's really deeply morally and ethically and from a parental position worried about culture, right? He's more religious than anyone I know, almost.
He is. He really is.
Yeah.
It's true. It's worried clergyman. That's a great image. Yeah. It's true. And all of this angst that, you know, his podcasts are full of.
Yeah.
I mean, in a lot of ways, he's not that different from, you probably don't know who this guy is, someone like Doug Wilson, who is a conservative reformed theonomist out there. But all of these religious people that are, you know, predicting fire and brimstone, and they're out there with all this angst, Sam Harris is right there with him. No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. It's such a hilarious image, but it's deeply true.
Yeah.
And I think that the difficulty, you know, and sort of, so my critique of the worried clergymen who actually embrace their religion is, and this is where I sort of am a tweener in this meaning crisis community. On one hand, you know, when, you know, I think John Vervaeke is right that there's no real just going back.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also don't see, you know, I remain, you know, deeply religious in a confessional church in this way, because I don't see letting go of any of this as helping in any way either. Yeah. So what I tend to believe is that what's going to the church in over long periods of centuries has sort of turned over. In, you know, G.K. Chesterton writes about this in the, I think it's the five deaths of the church or five deaths of Christianity, something like that, where there's going to need to be a new evolution in terms of what Christianity does and how it works in the world. And, you know, my money is still on Christianity because, and partly just because of its track record, because it's been astoundingly adept not only at cultural, basically getting into culture, but also the variety of cultures that it's been able to sort of adapt to. It's this strange system. So
totally.
Churches are in trouble.
Yeah. Well, except for reading this book, except for like in Africa and China.
Yeah.
Like look at like the Europe definitely is gone down, right? The US, except for different pot, is gone down. But like I think Africa has quadrupled or something like that.
And Asia. Year. Yeah, they're growing tremendously. But they're also tending to grow. They're growing in some of the newer forms of Christianity. So Pentecostal Christianity is one of the new iterations. You know, it came up in Los Angeles. It grew up in America, and it spread like wildfire all over the world. And it's an anti-modern, it's a reactionary thing. Modernity says miracles don't happen, and Pentecostal says, watch me do one.
Okay. Yeah. So Pentecostals, that's the speaking in tongues.
That right. Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're a real reaction to modernity. Modernity says, we don't believe any of these things. And the Pentecostals say, we don't believe in you. You know, we see miracles all over the place. And so it's a huge re-enchantment of the world. And so places like Africa and Asia, where secularism just sort of sat on the surface at the government bureaucrat business level, never really sunk down into the people, Pentecostalism came in and just, you know, a fire. Yeah. But...
Huh.
But the, you know, so one of the examples I like to look at is, so north of us up in Reading, there's a church. You should go up there sometime. Just take a look, because it's a very interesting experiment. There's a pastor named Bill Johnson, and he basically says, Jesus meant us to do miracles. Jesus didn't mean for us to be sick. And obviously the difficulty with that is that they do funerals in their church too. Yet there's this reaction to modernity and reaction to physicalism that they sort of tried to turn it around. And I think the weakness is going to be that you still have to deal with, I have a theological critique, which for me, you know, of what they're doing, but you still have to deal with what I call the age of decay. You still have to deal with death. And so I do believe we are going to see religious transformations at this scale are always enormously messy. I mean, probably the last one at this scale was the Protestant Reformation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, I mean, these are sort of like on a 500 year clock cycle. Now, maybe things are speeding up. I don't know. But
yeah.
But I don't think the thing is that any of us can know how this goes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. We can at best maybe track a little of it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And misunderstand it. Right. In the midst of it. Yeah. 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 There's something about so Yanaris. Are you familiar with his work? It's hard to describe him. He's probably the most prolific Orthodox theologian, modern theologian.
Unaris.
Yeah, I think so. Yanaris. And he's fascinating, because he got really into Heidegger, and he basically, I mean, this is so, I do not understand his work enough to even probably I'm probably not even misunderstanding it correctly, but the gist of it is, you imagine like where he took kind of Heidegger and that sense of being in the world, right? And that embedded, embodied, right, sense of things, and essentially drew underneath it back up and put underneath it the whole sense of the ineffable that the Orthodox have, right? The grounding, like a real grounding in that at the end of the day, right? Like just kind of like with your sense of your wife, right? Like that, that there's a one face of God that you will never, ever, ever, right? Will ever be object to you, right?
Yeah.
And that's essential for everything. And he has a way of looking at, right, I'd be fascinated just to hear what your take about this, because he has a whole thing about, he thought that the schism in the church, in the, what was it, 1100?
The Latin from the Eastern Church.
Yeah, makes sense on such a deep theological level to him. And also, is this split where the church in some sense became that's all part of technology in his view. Hmm. Right. And he has this whole way of looking at an ontology that really starts from relation. Like relation is fundamental to him. Right. And it's changed everything right up in the ineffable. And he's got a unique language because he's talking in all these kind of these deeply, deeply existential, like modern philosophical terms, but he's deeply philosophical. He's deeply theological. And he's doing hardcore theology. My sense is that it seems of what's speaking to people spiritually, right? And I know this is the case for me. Definitely. And like and I sense this with a lot of people, is even people who have no kind of religious yearnings have a sense of the ineffable, right? Yes.
Yep.
And that apophatic, right, sense to the universe, right? Like something around that, like something catching around that is what I see is possible, maybe even necessary.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It's, you know, I know some of my Jewish friends quibble with the translation, but, you know, the book of Ecclesiastes in the third chapter, after you have this beautiful song, you know, there's a time for this and a time for that.
Yeah.
God has placed eternity in our hearts. And what I see there is exactly what we started talking about in terms of why can't we continue, you know, why is it difficult to stare into the eyes of another human being for an extended period of time? Why is it we are suddenly ashamed when we are naked? Why is it you can be married to a woman for 35 years and have moments where you look at each other like, who are you?
Yeah.
I mean, there's all of these tells that, and I think the reason why these tells that I described, such as, you know, no matter how much we do in the 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years that we're given, we will only scratch the surface, even in a small domain, of what we invest ourselves in. Why is it that people are so mysterious? And I think it's because God is unfathomable. We can't reach bottom. And I, you know, C.S. Lewis, probably one of the best portrayals of this is in, you know, Lewis's Last Battle, where I'm really surprised that John, I was reading some Lewis the other day, and I thought, Lewis is such a Platonist. I'm really surprised John hasn't. I think at some point John is going to catch sight of what Lewis did. Lewis is first sort of easy to dismiss as an apologist, but right. Once people realize just what a Platonist he was, and what an applied Platonist he was, and how he applied his Platonism in children's books and everything else, I think once John gets a sense of what C.S. Lewis was doing, I think John's going to be all over him. But C.S. Lewis in The Last Battle, you know, I've heard John many times say things like he doesn't want to live forever, but I think the only the only reason we can responsibly comprehend an everlasting existence is because of the unfathomable, unknowable nature of God. We can't get to the bottom. And I know it's very difficult for our finite minds to think about the infinite, but that is basically at the bottom of Christian theology. And, you know, I think the Orthodox do that particularly well. You know, modernist Protestants, but still, even in Reformed Protestant theology, when asked about God, he's unboxable. You can know him relationally, which I think is our most profound mode of knowing.
Yeah.
You know, all four P's from John.
Yeah.
But even relationally, we will never get to the bottom. And to me, that is part of the reason why after 35 years, my wife and I still haven't gotten to the bottom of each other. And I don't think after 75 years, you know, will we be more? Yes. But it's only 75 years.
Right. Totally. And there's something, you know, what's also interesting. Now, I don't understand this enough to really talk much about this with Unaris, but one of the things I guess he did is he came up with a whole ontological metaphysical map that he calls a critical ontology. And he says it's an attempt to have a way of mapping these things that is self-corrective. And it seems like the thing that affords it to be self-corrective is, strangely enough, is this grounding in the apophatic, right? That this kind of sense of the mystery, right? And you're right, I think it represents itself in all of our relationships, right? It's also why we become, how we become people through other people, through relation, right? All of this is very, I think, very wedded together in a huge way. And it's funny because I know that for me, it's always, there's like in my relationship with God, if you will, right? It's, there's always for me this kind of, there's this tension between this personal aspect of it and this universal aspect, right? That withdraws in this way. And there's this sense in, I don't think it's just Orthodox. You can tell me this or not, but this sense where I know in Orthodox, where they talk about this deep way that God, they talk about God as person. Like, and it, that makes sense to me if I think about that in terms of like an actual person, which has this quality of this inexhaustibility, right? This ineffableness, right? But also this kind of coming forward of personalness, right? This personal phase. And so it's like, for me, that tension between those two aspects, right? I would say is kind of like, it seems to be part and parcel of like my own personal confrontation with God, is wrestling with this very thing that we're talking about, right? It seems like the wrestling itself is part of the worship, if you will.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. To be a Christian is to wrestle with God. Because, and it comes, so I was, when I, last time I was in, when I was in the UK last year, I got a question about miracles. And to me, miracles aren't the difficult thing to understand. It's the situation where it seems an undeserving people, an undeserving person from my perspective received a miracle, and a deserving situation did not. And James Scopp, he's an author. He taught at Dort University. He wrote a little biography on Mother Teresa. And Mother Teresa was, her story was quite amazing because everybody saw what she did and thought, oh, she's such a saint. But when you would read her journals and listen to what was going on, she believed God had abandoned her. And this kind of thing is not uncommon in, in history, where it is a wrestling with God. I mean, all the way from Jacob at the Jabbok River, it is a wrestling with God. And I think part of the reason so many people walk away from faith is because they're scared of the fight and they don't want the fight. You know, if there's a book about wrestling with God, it's the book of Job.
Yeah. Yeah. That's literally like essentially a debate, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the amazing thing is God seems to love the wrestle. God loves it when we don't back down. And like, you know, God, because Job goes after him.
Yeah.
And at the end of the book says, in all of this, Job did not sin. And then God shows up to his three friends who were giving him sort of this shallow karmic religion and says, Job's going to have to do sacrifices for you three because I'm not at all happy with you. They didn't wrestle with God one iota. They gave Job a shallow dogmatic formula. Surely, Job, you must have sinned because all of this calamity befell you. And we all know that favor with God is mirrored in fortunate circumstances in this world. And so, but Job, you know, Job hangs in there and goes after God with all that he has, which of course God is, you're not going to threaten him, but he's, you know, he loves it because in a sense, you know, to go back to, you know, the whole divorce kind of, you know, topic we were talking about before, the divorces sometimes happen when people stop fighting.
Yeah.
Now, you should fight in a productive way, but divorces happen when people stop fighting. I forget the marriage researcher, but you know, the whole eye roll thing. You know, you'd watch couples and when they'd roll their eyes, rolling your eyes is sort of a surrender.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Yeah.
I'm done fighting with you. Probably the marriage is going to be over.
Yeah.
And it's not always a bad thing. Some marriages should end. But I think with God, when people walk away, it's because they're done fighting.
Yeah.
And, So have you been exploring orthodoxy? Cause I remember the last time we talked, you talked about, you know, wanting to explore some of these things.
Yeah. I'm thinking about doing that here in Modesto to actually meet some people because I don't know how else to meet people actually here because I don't have a normal job. So I'm most of my social life is going back to San Francisco and, you know, traveling and seeing my kids and all that kind of stuff. So, but also, you know, just the sense of, you know, as my wife put it, she's like, well, where morally, like where is he going to get it then? Is he going to get it from you? Is he going to get it from me? Right? Like, it's like, what the hell do we know in some sense? Right.
Yeah.
So yeah. And I think a lot of my reading, kind of my philosophical reading with Orthodox has been kind of a warming up to that possibility and really doing that. And there's something really, you know, when you start looking at the symbolism of it and the there's very little of it that I have any problem with at all, right? It's all the way down to the enactment of the rituals. All of this sounds incredible, and I'm coming from a place where I don't have any kind of religious background. I was raised, like, technically I was raised Lutheran, but we never, you know, enacted any church. There wasn't much of that going on, right, when I was a kid. And I didn't start, there really weren't any conversations about God explicitly until my parents got sober in AA. Was the first time, which is a deeply, deeply Judeo-Christian organization. Fundamentally, as far as I can tell, that's a Judeo-Christian God, right? And big time. So then it became a very big conversation, right, that I was inside of, but not before that.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 12, 13.
Okay. So you were already fairly formed by that point.
Yeah. Yeah. I was already fairly formed. Yeah. So I'm leaning into it and opening it up, you know, and also this kind of sense, you know, reading this book about the family connection in its connection to the church.
What's the title of that book?
Let's see. I have it right here. Hang on 1 second. It's
not that I need to buy another book. This video thing has been bad for my habit. I need a 12-step book program to have more resistance buying and reading books.
It's called How the West Really Lost God.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Are you familiar?
Yeah. By Eberstadt?
Yep.
Yep.
I'm halfway through.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good book.
Yeah.
I don't have to buy that one because I already own it.
Okay, good. I have so many. I will not help you in stopping, you know, getting more books. I will not help you with that. I will encourage more books than. So it's really good talking with you again, Paul.
Oh, it's great talking with you. And you're just in, actually, I'm going to be close to your neck of the woods tomorrow. I'm going to be in Escalon for our classes meeting.
So, oh, wow.
You're just an hour and 15, 20 minutes away. Ripon, just north of Modesto, Ripon, California is the epicenter of the Christian Reformed Church in Northern California. You wouldn't imagine
it.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Dairy farmers and almond farmers.
Yeah. right on. Well, yeah. So I'll email you if you figure a way we could actually do meet in 3D. That'd be amazing.
I would love that. I would love to meet you in person.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
Good. It was great talking to you.
Always good talking with you.
Take care, guy.
Bye.
Bye-bye.